uyakwazi ukuthumela ama-email na.
We translate for those who can't understand. We write for those who can't hear. We describe for those who can't see. Subti, subtitles and accessibility for film, television and theater. Subti.com. Fred.
Hello and welcome to Fred Film Radio. I'm Amani Mohammed.
Fred Film Radio, sono Paolo De Marchi.
簡単にそのセンスの作品のあの紹介を。
Fred Film Radio, Sundana Night.
Clémence Ferry Latour for Fred Film Radio, en direct du Festival de Cannes.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Cinephile, you're listening to the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. The show is hosted and produced by me, Matt Micucci, and although it's almost hard to believe it, this is still the month of the 2021 Berlinale. So, over the course of this show, we will continue to honour our extensive coverage of the Berlin International Film Festival by sharing clips from interviews with its various guests that you can enjoy in full across our various channels in multiple languages. But that's not all, of course, because this past week, the Oscar nominations were announced. It's worth mentioning, even though I'm not going to be listing out all of the nominations. That would be crazy, but you can check those out on the Google machine. But it gives me a chance to tell you all that we do have interviews with several of this year's Oscar nominees, as well as lots of other content, including with Spike Lee, who has again been asked to chair the Cannes Film Festival jury after last year's event was cancelled because of the pandemic. That's just another of the many major film announcements from this past week. We'll also have guests, as usual, on the BFT. We'll be talking with Efie Blankevoort and Els van Driel, directors of Shadow Game, winner of the Grand Prize of Geneva in the creative documentary section at the International Film Festival and Forum on Human Rights in Geneva. You may remember that we had a chat about this very festival with its founder not too long ago. Also on this show, I will be speaking with my good friend Thomas Quain about his cool animated series Poxy Bleeding Chop, which you can watch on YouTube. Of course, it'll also be time for my new installment of the Dictionary of Film and Popcorn Classics segment. So there's lots happening, plenty to talk about, and I hope you'll stick around for it. Happy to have you aboard. Fire up on Audio Teeny, sit back, relax, and listen to the audio waves as they fly through the air.
Fred.
We begin the show by mentioning some interesting firsts for this year's Academy Award nominations. Romania has earned its first Oscar nomination for Collective by Alexander Nanau, and Kauter Ben-Hania's The Man Who Sold His Skin has earned an Oscar nomination as well, making this the first time a Tunisian feature has ever been nominated for an Oscar. Let's revisit my chat with the director herself about the film from last year's Venice International Film Festival, where it premiered. Take a listen.
Now, let me see if I can kind of give a brief description of what the story is like. The story is about the lead protagonist, who is a Syrian refugee, who in order to half driven by love and desperation, decides to sort of lend or absolutely give his back to a very powerful figure within the world of contemporary art. Is that a good...
I like very much the way you describe my character, so yeah, that's it.
Now, I'm interested as an art fan, not just a film fan, an art fan, whether you are fascinated with the contemporary art world, and I understand that this film is actually inspired by a true story. Is that true?
Yes, I like very much the contemporary world. I find it fascinating. I mean, it's full with contradiction. It's very elitist, and there is a lot of money. There is a lot of powerful figure, you know. It's like the progression of art arrived nowadays in a very strange place. So it's something that interests me a lot. And yeah, it's inspired by the work of the Belgian artist Wim Delvoye, who do a cameo in the movie. He's playing the part of the insurer,
right?
You know, so it's funny to take the real artist to give him the part of the insurer of the work, the artwork.
Yes.
And
Essentially, it's provocative art that's sort of examined. But I am curious because I do find that the film is also about freedom.
Exactly.
As well, right? Is that what it's about?
Yeah, I'm happy you saw this. It's a movie about freedom, your inner freedom, and when you are, you know, it's in contradiction with the rules, you know, where we live in, and how you find a way to impose your freedom, you know, to others. So to learn to be free, to be responsible with being free. So it's, the hidden theme, let's say, in the movie, it's about freedom.
So love, too, in a way, can trap us, right?
That's exactly. It's a movie about freedom and love, so...
they're basically very similar things, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a freedom to be loved and to love. So the character is driven by his... love to this woman, so he's in this kind of position where he don't have much of choice, and he have to make hard choices, you know, to recover his love. So he's not that free, but we know that he's free from the beginning in his head. So we have to conciliate between both kind of freedom, you know.
Sure. Well, speaking of difficult choices, I have a difficult choice to make now because we are completely out of time, but I have time for maybe one more question. Obviously, one of the things that I think is going to be discussed about this film is the fact that the lead character is a Syrian refugee, and I did kind of want to ask you whether there was a specific reason for that as well.
I mean, the question of refugee, it's a big question in Europe and everywhere in the world, you know. I think it's one of the next question of our world, and the paradox when you want to talk about freedom, that refugee, they are free people, you know, they don't want dictatorship, they want to flee problems, you know, they are mainly free, but all the doors are closed around them, nobody wants them to come, you know, because you have the figure of otherness, you know, he's coming from outside, from a war zone, and you have this contradiction that I wanted to think about in this movie. Yeah?
Sure. Well, I would have wanted to ask you about the style of the film itself, because I found it very great, at times recalling the classic giallos as well. So stylistically and visually, it's a delight, but we don't have any more time, unfortunately. But it has been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred.
Our first guests on this week's episode of the Big Fred Tuesday are directors Effie Blankevoort and Els van Driel, who are joining us today to talk about their latest powerful documentary, Shadow Game. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So we're going to be talking about your feature documentary, Shadow Game, which is the winner of the Grand Prize of Geneva in the creative documentary section at the International Film Festival and Forum on Human Rights in Geneva, Switzerland, this year. So first off, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
To briefly introduce it, before we get into it a bit more, this is a film about underage migrants fleeing war or poverty to basically get to Europe. And we will be talking about it in more detail. This is just a very, very short introduction, as I've said. But first off, also because this is the first time that we speak, that we talk, I'd like to find out more about you. How did you... to meet, and where did your collaboration begin, and when did your collaboration begin?
Well, actually, we go way back, long ago. We met each other when we were 20, I think, during our student time in Amsterdam. We were both working in a film theater called Criterion, which is a unique place where only students work, and we had a great time there, programming films and making discussions about films. Yeah, that's where our friendship began. So we became friends, and after several professional years as a journalist, we both were involved in issues concerning migrants, migration, asylum policies. So we started working together, and we made several films together and projects, and that's how it all began. So we have a common interest and also a common vision on how our films or projects should have impact to our publics.
How much does your background in journalism shape that vision?
I think our background in journalism is like the foundation of what we do. We tell stories that are true. We try to find new ways to tell urgent stories. I think also we try to find different perspectives on the stories. So I think that's, for us, it's really like the basics of journalism in that sense.
And do the origins of your interests in film and the potential of the filmmaking medium coincide with the birth of your activism?
Yeah, I think it goes together. I mean, we tell stories because we think it's urgent and it's important to show to the world that this is happening in our world. So it's a passion and it's a motivation to do our work as journalists as well. I think for most journalists, it's that motivation. But for us, it goes one step further, that we also want to connect the public to the story and to really give something that they can do also to change the situation if they are upset about it. To call us activists, I don't know. I have a little bit of problem with that because it's something else for me. But I think film is a very powerful tool to connect people and really connect to emotionally also to the subjects of human rights issues, for instance.
Humanizing human rights.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it.
So coming to a Shadow Game, just to start off, begin talking about it, what was the main driving point for you to explore this topic, the topic of migration?
Well, for us, I think the last few years or maybe decades, we've seen a huge deterioration in the way we accept or we help people who seek protection in Europe, who come here as refugees. We've seen it happening. We made a film before about the EU-Turkey deal, where we went to the island of Lesbos. We talked to the people who live there, who try to help refugees, so the locals, but we also, talked, of course, to refugees themselves. And we talked to the architect of the deal to understand, what was the idea about it and what are the consequences, actually. That's actually, yesterday it was the anniversary of that deal. It's 5 years ago now. And since then, we've only seen it gotten worse and worse. And human rights in Europe are really being violated on a daily basis. That was the starting point, or maybe one of the starting points to continue making films about this issue. And for us, the fact that children, fleeing often war-torn countries in search of protection, who come to Europe, are left on their own. They're not protected in Europe, was really shocking to see. The first time we saw that was on Lesbos. But we've seen it all through Europe. And yeah, so that was one of the reasons to make this film, of course.
And just because you mentioned it, and also because I wouldn't want to leave any of the listeners out. And as well as that, it's good to kind of get that information out there as clearly as possible, because raising awareness is definitely important and I'm sure is part of your filmmaking mission. How would you explain that deal that you mentioned, that you referred to someone who doesn't maybe know that much about it?
Well, it's a complicated deal. The idea behind the deal was that Turkey would take refugees back in order that people would not take the dinghies, the very dangerous journey on sea. In return, Turkey would get a lot of money from the EU. But in many ways, the deal failed. The idea was originally a little bit also to protect people, but also to protect human rights and to have a decent conditions in reception centers and also decent procedures on the Greek islands. But all that failed. So the Greek failed. The EU failed in protecting people and taking people from Turkey, because that was also part of the deal, to get them directly from Turkey on a plane and distribute them amongst the European countries. That they didn't do. And Turkey said in the end, okay, you're not taking the refugees, then we are not taking them back. So they're still coming on dinghies to the Greek islands. So in many ways it failed, and it deteriorated a lot because people also because countries also raised their fences because of the 2015 situation. They were scared that a lot of people would come from Greece to their countries. So the border violence increased a lot. And also the situation in Greece is worse than ever before. And they're actually, Greece is now, with the financial support also of European Union, actually pushing back people, putting them on dinghies again, on sea, and leaving them behind, also children. People are dying at sea now. So it's a very alarming situation. It's happening on our continent. And that's what really, makes us angry and embarrassed as well. And that's also a reason why we really want to have impact with our film, to show that this is the reason why these kids who arrive in Greece are continuing their journey into Europe. They are not able to stay in Greece. There's no future there. There's no system there. It's a failed state. There's no work. There's no housing for refugees. So they have to continue their journey in search of protection in Europe. In Turkey, they can also not stay because there's no jobs there either, and they are seen as, second-class citizens. For instance, one of our boys had been working in Turkey in a factory with long hours, like 14 hours a day without payment, maltreatment for years when he was 14 already. So, yeah, he had to continue his journey into Europe to look for a future. He was from Syria, so he couldn't go back, and he couldn't stay in Turkey either. So that's what's happening every day. And yeah, we think it's such an urgent issue. And we're also addressing our own government, like the Netherlands. They're not taking any people from Greece, whereas Greece has said, please help us. We cannot deal with these numbers of people and children as well. So yeah, we're really trying to get this message out. Please do something. We have to show that our morals, we have to show that we are keeping up our human rights. That's what the continent stands for, right? That's what Europe wants to stand for. Then we have to act.
We'll be right back for more on Shadow Game in a moment.
Red Film Radio.
We're back with Efje Blankevoort and Els van Driel, directors of Shadow Game. We talked a lot in the first part of the interview about the beginning of their collaboration, their interest in the topic of migration, and even explored some of the aspects that make migration such an urgent situation. One of the things that it has originated or birthed it is this concept of the game that we see represented in the documentary itself. In fact, Els, Efje, I feel the term game is very important in your film, and I feel it prompts further explanation. How would you explain its meaning in the context of this film and of this story? And when did you first become aware of this concept of game that is widespread among the young people whose lives you document in Shadow Game?
Yeah, so it was quite shocking for us when we heard it for the first time, the game, in reference to the crossing of borders, which is like really, really dangerous. People die trying it. So we are quite shocked that people, especially kids, use it. We think it comes from Afghans in the first place, or the Pakistanis, because that's where many of them use it. The Syrians less, and the other kids we met from different countries also used it less at first. But it became commonplace the last 2 years, I think. We started to hear it more and more. And what we think, why they use it, it's a way they can cope with their situation. It's like a coping mechanism. To call it a game, it sort of makes it, I guess they can deal with the hardships better. And so they use the term for all these different games. And it's like you have the train game, in which they hide underneath trains, or the truck game, when they go inside the back of a truck. The pedestrian games, when you have to walk a lot because there's a lot of walking. And one of the kids who explained it to us really well, Eski from the film Afghani Boy, he did say, like, you know, it is like a game. It's a mission. If you win, if you fail, you lose. You try again, but in the end, you need to win the game. So yeah, it's really a bitter ironic term, I think, but it I think why we used it in the film, we showed it how these kids see it. It's because again, it gives them some sort of hope that they can one day make it. You can try and try, and in the end, they will make it. And it plays into this this sort of universal youthful experience that I think a lot of youngsters will recognize.
When you're working on a project like this and you're meeting these young protagonists of the film that you, whose lives you tell, how do you approach them and what is their reaction to your idea of telling their story in a documentary?
Well, the research was really interesting. We did just go to the places where we knew they would be. So there are a lot of hubs, refugee hubs, so to speak, where they're stranded or stuck before a border. So we went to these places, and sometimes it was outside or inside a refugee camp, or sometimes it was just inside the woods or in an abandoned building or under a bridge. And we just hang around with the guys and talked and listened to their stories. What was interesting was that some of them had been filming their own journey as well, because they were really amazed and astonished by what they were going through and all the walking they did and all the dangers they saw. So they had been filming and making videos, and they showed this to us, and then we got this idea, okay, we have to include their material and we can really make this film together then. And that they were enthusiastic about, so that's how it all came about. And we also, after some time researching some days, then we called our cameraman, Tom Peters, to fly in once we had permission to film, of course. And then we started filming with a very small team. So we were only Afia and I and Suhor Al-Kaisi, who is a refugee herself from Iraq. She's a journalist living in the Netherlands, and she could speak Arabic, of course. And then Tom Peters, the cameraman. So we were only with the four of us, and we started filming.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You mentioned that they film themselves while they're on this quote unquote game. So it's interesting what we see in this documentary, because again, it's something that we don't necessarily think about immediately. But their use of social media within this game is quite interesting. I don't think I've ever seen it explored as much as it is explored in your documentary here.
Yeah, that was really surprising to us as well. I mean, but why were we surprised actually? I mean, they're young kids,
yeah,
and they
exactly,
have their phones,
yeah.
So of course they have social media, and of course they're using it, you know. And that was the nice thing about it. I mean, they use it when they're bored, because there's, besides going on game, which is really adventurous, exhilarating, and very dangerous at the same time. In between those games, so to say, they are stuck in camps often, so from sometimes for weeks or months. So they're really bored. So then they use social media just to, you know, go on Insta, see what's happening around the world with their friends, just like, you know, European youngsters would do as well. And at the same time, we saw that they document their journey and also share it sometimes on the social media, especially on TikTok. And we saw it the most with the kids coming from Afghanistan. There's people who have their whole profiles filled with these short clips of them doing the game, or, you know, talking about how life is in on the road going to Europe. And I think what we understand from a lot of kids that we talk to, they said to us, you know, we never thought we would have to go through such a journey, that we would have to experience such hardships. So we wanted to document it. We want to document what we went through. And again, at the same time, make it more lighthearted, I guess, more playful, also in a way to deal with it. So sometimes on TikTok, you find these short clips of kids dancing in the back of a truck, doing the truck game, so to say, and they put music underneath, and it all looks so much fun. And the same goes for clips where you see youngsters hanging from the back of a train. And they just make fun of it in a way. So it's really shocking. And at the same time, I think, yeah, you know, they're kids, they're youngsters. So of course they make a joke about it in that way.
Of course, it's also for their families to show that they're fine, right? They're having fun in Europe. So it's a little bit ironic as well.
Well, you never see, almost never see, indeed, sad posts online, because that's also what we hear from all of the kids almost, is of course I don't tell my parents or parents, because often they are they don't have a father anymore, but they don't tell their mothers that they're, you know, in a bad situation because they came to Europe to do something for themselves or for families, and they don't want to have them worry about them. So all their Facebook posts are fun and it's fine, you know, and in reality they're in really, really bad circumstances. So there's a really big gap between reality and social media reality.
We'll be back for the third part of the interview on Shadow Game in a moment.
Fred Film Radio.
And we are back with Efje Blankevoort and Els van Driel, directors of Shadow Game, winner of the Grand Prize of Geneva in the Creative Documentary section at the International Film Festival and Forum on Human Rights in Geneva, Switzerland this year. So, guys, how long were you working on this film for?
I think in total, more than 3 years of filming. And of course, before that, we started writing about researching and writing the subject. So in total, about 4 years, going to four and a half now with all the editing.
Yeah. Obviously in different countries and so very, very difficult production, we can say.
Well, it was and it wasn't. I actually really loved making the film because it was it was a form of journalism that I really love, from a form of documentary making that I really love. Of course, we have an idea of what we wanted to film, the stories we hoped we could find, and we had an idea about how we would like to film it. So everything from the perspective of the kid, be really, really close to them. Don't involve any adults or experts or whatever. So we did have a clear plan. And at the same time, when we would go to a place, we never knew what to expect. We knew where maybe there were people would be. We didn't know where the kids would be from, if they would be still there the next day because they could go on game. And so it was just go with the flow completely. It was about, you know, just going there, hanging around with the kids, getting to know them, gaining trust, and then, okay, let's see, let's go. We're going to film you and let's stay in touch. And we stayed in touch with all of these kids, sometimes for 2 or 3 years over WhatsApp and Messenger. And whenever there was something going on that we find, okay, we have to be there now. We have to include this in their story. We would fly out the next day. So it was really sort of, exhilarating to do that as well.
What is it like kind of working in this environment? I'm thinking of the sequences where they're close to the fences or other dangerous situations. How do you react to those? Does it ever get too much? Are you ever scared of what might happen, frightened, concerned?
Well, it was tense and it was also new for us because we never were at the borders in that sense. You know, we only crossed borders as tourists with our passports, and this was a completely different side of the border that we never had seen. But the most scary moments were actually when the kids were out of off the radar for us. So when we were back home and they were not online, and we knew that they were going on game and they were in the back of a truck or they were walking through Croatia, and we know what the Croatian border guards do. They just kick the kids and they throw them in rivers and give them electroshocks, etc. So they're torturing at the border. We knew that they were going through this, and that kept us awake often. And we were so glad that all of our boys finally made it as well. And that there are people dying. Just some weeks ago, there was a group of Pakistani boys that went into a minefield at the Croatian border, and one of them got killed, and several really severely injured. So that could have happened to our boys as well. And we were saying to each other, okay, one day this telephone call will come that one of them has died, and that really scared us. And we saw a lot of suffering as well amongst the refugees that they were the groups that they were in. I mean, there were also mothers with small children who were completely psychologically panicked, and babies that were almost frozen, and you know, it was the tragic of all these stories and going in and going back home again, because you're only part of their stories for several days or a week. That was really hard to combine it with our own lives, actually, in our privileged cities in Europe.
Yeah, and I thank you very much, because we've definitely exceeded the time that we talked about this interview would last. But it's such a fascinating conversation. I'll just maybe ask you a couple of more questions, one or two.
Sure.
One of them is, of course, having worked on a film like this, what do you feel about the future regarding this issue? Are you guys optimistic? Are strides being made forward in dealing with the issue of migration, or are we still living in the dark ages?
Well, I'm always optimistic. I'm optimistic by heart, but we've met so many people on the road who try to turn the tide, who do something for the refugees. But politically speaking, we're in the dark ages completely. We've just had the Dutch election here. We just had the results yesterday. And again, extreme right parties, populist parties, gained a lot of seats in parliament again. And we see xenophobia, anti-refugee rhetoric, increase by the day. One point I want to make in that context, actually, is that I think also for us as journalists, we have a great responsibility to counter that rhetoric. And one of the things we can do is to stop calling these people migrants and start calling them refugees again. Because when you come from Syria and you flee from the war, you're not a migrant, you're a refugee. And I think it's really important because that's also one of the things we've seen happening, that journalists all over Europe are taking over this anti-refugee rhetoric from the politician. And I think we really have to be careful about that, because words do count. So I'm pessimistic about the political environment in Europe, all over Europe. And at the same time, there's a lot of grassroots organizations that are mobilizing people to counteract against this xenophobia. So I do have hope that we can still make a change before it's really too late.
You talked about journalism, but what about the language of filmmaking?
Yeah, I mean, for me, a film like Shadow Game is also journalism, but using different tools. It's telling a story in a very captivating way, but it still tells, I think, the story of what the consequences of our European asylum system are. So that's, I think, it's part of the journalism, I think. What a film adds to it, a film like Shadow Game, is that you can really take people into the world of these kids to show what is happening in Europe from their perspective. And maybe that can help them change their views, or maybe at least add a perspective on this whole issue, which is very complex.
Yeah, what is the biggest compliment that we got from the youth jury now in Geneva was that they could really relate to these kids. I mean, they are the same age and they have the same aspiration and same hopes for their lives. And the style of the film, and that was a big compliment for us, was indeed in their own style and in their own feeling of, resilience and hope. And that was a big compliment, because most refugees films that we've seen are about poor refugees, quote unquote. It's like they are victims only, but these are people with talents. They're not coming here to get something from us. Yes, they want protection, but then they want to add something to our societies. They also want to give their talents a chance and to become who they want to be.
Thank you very much for joining us. And again, it's been a fascinating conversation. I remind our listeners, the film is called Shadow Game. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're
for
welcome.
Having us.
Thank you.
Fred.
As mentioned at the start of the show, Spike Lee will be the president of the jury at this year's edition of the Cannes Film Festival. That, at least for now, is scheduled to take place on the Croisette from the 6th to the 17th of July. Time to revisit Angelo Cerbi's chat with the great filmmaker about Black Klansman from the 2018 Venice International Film Festival. Take a listen.
Listen, you just ended a panel about innovation in cinema.
Yes.
And how much innovation changed your cinema so far? If it did.
Well, technology has changed how I make films. I've embraced it. But I still make a point that I'm not going to let the technology control me. I think that's a mistake when people use the technology to control their creativity. So I'm very on point for that.
Your last film is about an historical part of U.S. history, a recent one, and you love to picture it in a very classic way because, you know, the ambience, the atmosphere, the historical precision was really great. How did you work on that, and how long did it take you to get to that goal?
Well, I forgot how long. We made the film a little under a year, but the film takes place in the 70s, so that's upon myself, my DP, Chase Irvin, the production designer, Kurt Beach, and costume designer, that we all had to, Marcy Rogers, costume designer, we had to be focused, that we have to evoke the era that the film takes place. We had to be uniform and concert, and everybody do their job.
And the music.
Well, the music is me. I curate all the music on my film, and we had a great, great score by Terrence Blanchard. So everything came together on this film, and I like to say to people that it's a very, very hard, it's very hard to make a bad movie. So you know how it is to make a good film or a great one. So, and again, timing takes a lot to do with stuff, and BlacKkKlansman was a very good film at the right time.
Exactly. This was my last question, because your film is very accurate in terms of politics.
Yes.
And do you believe you are? I think that you believe the films must be political too, a little bit, or not?
I've never said that. What I will say respectfully is that if you're an artist and you make the choice not to involve art in your, not, excuse me, let me start again. If you're an artist and you make the choice not to involve politics in your art, that's a political choice in itself.
Well, luckily you choose not to do that this time.
Well, the subject matter, for me, everything goes by the script. And you talk about the Klan and all this stuff, how can that politics not be involved in that?
Well, thank you very much for your time. Thanks a lot to Spike Lee. I'm Angelo Cerbi for Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Thank you. This is Spike Lee. Ciao.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, this is the second installment of the new segment of my Big Fred Tuesday that I erroneously called Dictionary of Film, but will actually change the name of. From now on, it will be called the Cinephile Dictionary. Very simple concept. Each week I choose a term and expand on it by giving out a definition and examples that will help you have a better understanding of various aspects of the filmmaking language, film industry, and so on, film culture at large. And even if you know what these terms mean, it's just a bit of fun to go over them again. This week's letter is the letter B, and the term I have chosen has more to do with the narrative of any given film. It is the term Brechtian, a word that originates from Bertolt Brecht, one of the most influential radical playwrights and poets of the first half of the 20th century. Of course, it's not a term that is exclusive to the cinematic language and is also used in theatre, as well as other types of performing and narrative art forms. So, what does it mean? Well, very simply, the Brechtian technique is a technique used in theatre and cinema that prevents the audience from losing itself completely in the narrative, instead making it a conscious and critical observer. It counters the approach of the naturalist theatre or cinema, where the audience is prompted to follow the narrative and care about a play or film's events and characters wholly by attracting attention upon the method with which the narrative is brought to the stage or, in this case, to the screen. Generally speaking, Brechtian films are not of an escapist nature and may even be a bit more challenging to watch. Brechtian techniques in cinema may include anything as common as breaking the fourth wall or non-linear or non-chronological development of the narrative, alienating editing techniques, or in the case of a film like Lindsay Anderson's If from 1968, the random mixture of colour and black and white stock sequences. One of the most famous practitioners of Brechtian techniques in cinema is Jean-Luc Godard, who, among other greats of the French New Wave, very often utilized it to political ends. I feel it's interesting to note that Brecht himself was far more prominent in theatre than in cinema. In fact, To the best of my knowledge, his only screen credit is as a screenwriter for the film Hangmen Also Die with fellow German emigre Fritz Lang. The film is from 1943 and, as far as I remember it, it wasn't very Brechtian at all, but it is quite a good film that I would recommend you watch, also because of the fact that it is a noteworthy collaboration between these two great artists. There you have it, folks. That was this week's Cinephile Dictionary entry, Brechtian. Hope you enjoyed that one, although I'm sure many of you were already familiar with the term to begin with, but it's always good to touch up on our knowledge. We'll be back for more chat about cinema in a moment.
Fred.
Joining me at this time is a friend of mine, Thomas Quain, creator, director and animator of the web series titled Poxy Bleeding Shop. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi, how's it going? It's fantastic to be here, Matt.
I'm doing pretty well. These are crazy times.
It's great to be here, yeah. They are crazy times.
These are crazy times. It's been a year since we last talked, and the world is a different place. It seems like it was a lot longer ago.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of time is just a very strange thing now, and everything which was normal and everything you took for granted is changed.
Yeah. Yeah, and we were talking about it earlier. We're actually recording this interview on Paddy's Day, and we didn't even know, because we just figured, you know, it was a normal Wednesday. We didn't even realize.
Just a Wednesday, yeah.
It was the most important day.
Yeah, but it's perfect. It's perfect in a way, talking to an Irish person. So
exactly, yeah. So, Tom, we should tell the listeners, you and I have actually known each other for a while, for years.
We have.
We went to
film
school.
We should be honest about this.
Together, yeah, yeah.
We shouldn't hide this fact.
Exactly. Went to film school together ages ago in Galway, long story short. And I've always thought this, you were always probably the most talented of the bunch.
Well, I think there was a lot of talented people, but yeah, I think I was definitely the most, you know, stubborn person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That too. Well, since then, you have been creating all sorts of filmmaking projects between live action, fiction features, documentaries, and animation. The latter is what we will be focusing on and talking about today, and we will be specifically talking about your animated series, Poxy Bleeding Shop. Now, for those unfamiliar with it, how would you introduce it?
So Poxy Bleeding Shop is a 2D animated series that is a comedy, and it follows the staff in an off-license in a rough area of town in Ireland, and it's about the off-license and the staff and the colourful characters that frequent the shop. It's a web series, and the themes in the series are alcohol abuse, homelessness, and the importance of community.
Now, this is an international radio, so here's a silly question. What are the definitions for those terms, poxy and bleeding here?
Yeah, that's a very good question. That term is very much a colloquial expression in Ireland, where anything that you're frustrated or annoyed by, you say poxy bleeding job, or in this case, because we were in the shop, it's based on a true story where I was working the off license. We would frequently say to each other, every time something awful happened in the shop, we would frequently say to each other, oh, poxy bleeding shop.
So this story, I mean, is inspired from personal experience.
It is, unfortunately.
Right.
I think I've taken a liberty with some of the story, but I think I've tried to remain very true to the characters. So yeah, so I worked in the in and off license. And it was kind of in a rough area of town for a couple of months. While it was very difficult and very frustrating, I think out of that, I was kind of inspired that, gee, while this is a terrible situation, there's a great story here in terms of the amount of issues you can be talking through one location. So the kind of goal was to say that, to kind of talk about a community through a shop, and through the shop, which sold alcohol, you could kind of be addressing these issues like homelessness, like alcohol abuse. But obviously those are very heavy issues. So I think the injection of comedy was very important. There were two seasons. So the initial season I made in 2018, just after I finished working there, was very much a personal expression of a personal experience. And it was a bit like art therapy in a way, where you're kind of figure out how do I deal with this situation. It was kind of me attempting to make a commercial project, but also it was making art in response to try and understand how I feel about it. I suppose it's a kind of coping mechanism as well, I suppose.
Yeah. Was that a drive when you first started to basically teach yourself how to do animation? Because I remember years ago when we were studying in GMIT, there was no animation course, as far as I can remember anyway. So you basically taught yourself.
I think there is an animation course on the course since then, but it's only because animation has become quite a big thing. But I taught myself the animation program, or I always had that, the passion and interest in animation. And I think just I was always looking for a project or a story that I could do through animation. And I think just when I was in the shop, I felt just that there was an interesting opportunity here to take up animation. And if I was doing it through live action, it would be a lot harder, because you would have to, you know, find a place to film in terms of an off license, get a location. And obviously I couldn't do it where I was working, because that would just be adding insanity to insanity. And then because it's kind of an ensemble, a cast, because there's a number of people who come in and out of the shop, of the customers, you would have had to get a lot of cast. And it just seemed like live action wasn't the way to go. So I felt strongly that animation was the way to go. And I did it. It's hard to explain what the drive was. I guess I wanted to be doing it, so I did it.
Yeah. Well, it was just another way, I guess, to express yourself through another filmmaking language, because like I said, you're also filming live action stuff and documentaries too. So it is another language, I guess.
Yeah, and the live action, be it a feature or a short or a documentary, they're different forms. And I think the mediums allow you to do different things, but the web series as well was kind of perfect, I felt. I never even thought of making it a short. There were so many stories and so many things happened there. It seemed very much perfect for the episodic nature of a web series. So that was the way I always wanted to go with it.
Yeah, and so when you first started to kind of, as we said, sort of teach yourself how to do animation, was it just a matter of you sitting in front of a blank page with some pencils? What was that like?
It was all computer. It started off like when I was in the job, I was doing some drawings in the job on the back of receipts and stuff. I would just draw people in their costumes, maybe their hairstyle, maybe some dialogue, because I realized very quickly the dialogue was so rich and so amazing. So very often I would have a computer screen open, you know, a tab open where I'd have a till on one tab, and then I'd have another page open where I'd be taking down some of their words and dialogue before I was even thinking of a web series. I was just thinking the way they're speaking is so interesting and so amazing. But I gradually built up so many drawings of the kind of the hair, of the clothes, so many pages and pages of dialogue. I must have had 20 or 30 pages just of dialogue without any plot, just loads of dialogue and quotes. And I just sat down, I started drawing. Well, I was in Dublin in that time in 2017, and I went out of Dublin in 2018, and I studied animation in Cardiff. But I feel very strongly that I taught myself a lot, as it was a master's and it was very much a hands-off thing. But what they did was they would give me kind of nudges in the way I could form the story on that course. But I was over in Cardiff for a year from September to May, somewhat on my own, and just spending all day in front of a computer. It was all a computer. It was all drawn on a pad, and I animated on the Adobe programs.
And so in terms of influences, is there anyone that you look up to in terms of animation style, but also in terms of this satirical narrative style that sort of defines Poxy Bleeding Shop?
Is it satirical? I don't know. Is it?
I find it is, yeah. Satirical comedy.
Yeah.
Dark satirical comedy.
It is definitely is dark, and it's satirical in that it is contemporary. It's not, you know, nostalgic at all. It's very much set in the present, like some episodes of South Park, maybe, as that became less or less about, you know, timeless stories, and it became more the satire took over in South Park. But that was a big influence. South Park was another one that was a big influence, was the big Les Show, which is an Australian animation that was produced by a guy on his own in Australia. And he just produced certainly three, but maybe four or five seasons. And he actually made a film of the big Les Show as well. And that was very much like Poxy Shop, what all of us were trying to do, in that it was very much a personal expression of the world. And I think our series is that as well. I also enjoyed, while it was on, but it stopped recently, which is, I was kind of sad to hear, is Kim's Convenience on Netflix, which was the story of a small shop in a kind of small underrepresented community. And I was sad to see that finish recently. I love, but that's not animation, but it's just a good series and it kind of have the storyline in common. And I love Bob's Burgers as well. That's just great, in the family and community aspect. But I don't think we took a lot from that, but it's just a great animation.
We'll be back for more on Poxy Bleeding Shop in a moment.
Red Film Radio.
And we are back with Thomas Quain, creator, director and animator of the animated web series Poxy Bleeding Shop. And that is what we've been talking about on this show. Tom, how long did it take you to work on the series?
So at the moment there are two seasons of Poxy Bleeding Shop. So the 2018 season, which I think actually came out in 2019 or the end of 2018 or the start of 2019, that took the 6 months that I was in Cardiff for. And then season two now, season two started production. Let me try and get my facts straight here. So I initially started writing the scripts in summer 2019, because before any animation done, obviously you need to write scripts. And when I finished the first season, there was just a lot of ideas left over, a lot of characters left over, a lot of situations left over. So I initially finished the scripts in about summer 2019, and I started doing some tests for season two in about September 2019. But at the time, you know, everything was normal and I was working a full-time job. I was doing some teaching and filmmaking, and I was working a normal retail job. And but anytime I would have a day off, I would go to the local library and plug in there and just animate as much as I could. And my plan was just to have it done by January or February 2020. But I remember thinking by around November 2019 that I was really concerned that A, I wasn't getting as much done as I thought I would, which is no surprise really, because I can see looking back I was busy, but also B, more importantly, that it wasn't up to the standard that I really had in my head. So that was anyway November. Christmas came and went, you know, I was busy with jobs, busy buying presents and family and Christmas and all that thing. But I said to myself in January that I would really do it a lot more and try and really buckle down to it in January as my job hours were going down. But then in January, there was an election on. Well, there was an election on the start of February, but I was doing a documentary when I was chatting to you. So I was doing that over the course of January and February on the Irish election. And while I was shooting that and kind of going around the country, doing a bit of traveling, interviewing people and filming it, I remember thinking in the back of my head, like, geez, I really need to get back to this animation that I've kind of promised myself I would be finishing right now. And then, well, you know, like a lot of people, everything changed for me in March, like it changed for everyone else. When the pandemic hit in the middle of March, my teaching finished overnight, my job closed, and I was just only at home every day. And it's really when the animation started in full. So I would just be at home, sitting down, table chair, cup of coffee beside me. And I would animate from maybe 10 in the morning to maybe 11 in the evening. And I got another job then, and all that continued really from March to August. And it really only finished then. And I kind of worked another part-time job for a while in September to Christmas 2020. But then I went back on the animation. I was trying to do a shot every afternoon when I would come home. But the animation really only got done in January and February 2021 when I went back on it full time. Do you know what I mean? That was quite a long answer now. Sorry.
No, but it sounds like, well, that kind of gives an idea of what a crazy year it's been. And also, yeah, it sounds like that having that animation process, having that animation project might have even helped you from maybe just going a bit crazy with everything that was happening, with the instability of it all.
Absolutely, yeah. I was lucky, as I was said, that I had started the tests in September and I had about 10 minutes of animation, but it's not in the finished series. It's just, it's people who are walking across the screen. It's me playing around with colors, with the backgrounds. And the fact that I had done that for three or four months before the pandemic really gave me a grounding that when the pandemic hit, I didn't feel I was just jumping into a project because I had time on my hands. It was much more of a case that, okay, now I have the time that I needed to be doing this project. And yeah, it could have been a very frustrating 12 months from March 2020 to March 2021 where we are now. But I feel like I managed to pull something out of it, which is cool. So I'm proud of that.
And you've also got an interesting voice cast here.
Yeah, so we do have an interesting cast. Season one, like I said before, was very much a personal expression of a personal experience. It kind of felt logical to me, even though it didn't seem make a lot of sense to other people. But it made sense to me that I would do all the voices for season one because it was just such a personal experience. And it was very much a rough series where I didn't feel I could justify bringing in other people when the series was at kind of an early stage of development. But if I did a second season, which was always the goal, by the way, because I always want to improve what I did in season one, but I always wanted to bring in more cast. So in season two, there's something like 6 or 7 people. So I have a mixture of people who I've worked with before and I have people who I've never worked with. So my friend Aidan J. Collins, who was in a play of mine, he voices three characters. He does the voices of the guards, Foley. He does the voice of the guards and he does the store manager. Bernard Casey, who's a great comedian from Kerry here in Ireland, does the voices of Brian, one of the store assistants. Coleman Hayes, who was in some of my short films back in college. He holds actually the record. He voices 4 voices, I think. He does the voices of Bono, of Brendan, who's one of the local alcoholics, as well as some of the alleyway thugs, Craig and Greg. Emma Doran, who's a very well-known Irish comedian who's played in places like the O2 and Vicar Street in Dublin. She plays the character of Celine. Carl Spain, who's very well-known in Ireland for doing shows on RTE and playing comedy gigs, does the voice of Liam, who's a homeless character who lives outside the shop. And it was important, by the way, for me to have a homeless character as one of the lead characters. As like I said, excuse me, homelessness was one of the key themes, and to have a character who was homeless, but also a character who you could invest in and you felt was a real character and you could believe was a real character. So he plays a homeless character who lives in a phone box outside the shop. Who else do I have? I have a list here just now, I'm going through it. Mark McCauley, who is in another short film of mine, but is a great actor and has done some of his own plays since then. He plays the mystery man who is owed some money from the previous owner of the shop. Owen Colgan, who's very well known again in Ireland. He's on Irish TV and he's a very, very funny guy. He plays the role of Eddie, who's a local drug dealer, who is also a crocodile. So there is a kind of element of surrealism in there.
Yeah, definitely.
And just final 2 or 3 names is another very extremely popular comedian and writer, by the way, who was in the RTÉ series The School, is Tadhg Hickey, who plays a cheeky seagull who torments a lot of the locals. And he also plays the role of Joey, who is an alcoholic and who is also a banana. And Valerie Lynch plays the role of Emily, who, how would you describe her? Well, she runs the community center in the area and she also holds a grudge against a lot of people in that community as well. So it was a big cast, yeah.
And finally, Tom, when and where will people be able to see the show? And is there any way that people can keep up with the news about the series?
Absolutely. So Poxy Bean Shop Season 2 comes out tomorrow, actually. The very first episode is tomorrow, which is March the 18th, Thursday. And so there are 7 episodes and they're going to be put out every Thursday from the 18th. So it'll be basically on the 18th, the 25th. The 1st and the 8th and the 15th. And I think the 22nd then is the last episode. And it can be followed on Facebook, just type in Poxy Bleeding Shop. We're on Twitter, Poxy Bleeding Shop. And there's Instagram as well. But Facebook and Twitter are the main places. And there is, you can follow there. And I also made a series of some vlogs over the summer and September and October. So if you want to learn more about the background, the making of it, you can check out those vlogs as well.
Yeah, those are very interesting. Yeah, they're vlogs basically that kind of reveal how you were able to get this all to come together. It's very interesting stuff.
Mm.
All right, Tom. Okay, so is there anything else that you're working on at the moment?
Well, I'm, you know, because we're coming to the end of this, well, we're doing, there are a couple of things we're doing. The first thing is we're trying to get other people interested. We feel interested in the project, people maybe who might be interested in supporting the project. So we feel we have a commercial project which has something to say. So we've applied to RT and to TG4, looking for support. And we're also maybe looking to someone like Channel 4, which would be fantastic because we feel we have a commercial project. And the other thing is we're developing another series, another Irish-centered series, because we feel that's our strong point, to develop original material which is Irish and which hasn't been seen before, because there's not a lot of adult Irish animation in Ireland. So we feel that's kind of a gap in the market, to use a cliched expression, that we want to kind of explore a bit more of.
Tom, it's been a pleasure talking with you. So best of luck with the series. Matt, I remind the listeners it's called Poxy Bleeding Shop. Check that out. Thanks very much, Tom.
Thank you, Matt.
Fred Film Radio.
I'm Your Man was one of the most talked about films of the 2021 Berlinale, and Chiara Nicoletti had a chat about it with its director Maria Schrader and its screenwriter Jan Schoenberg. Here's a clip of that interview.
So I was curious to know, obviously, the starting point for I'm Your Man, because I read, first of all, that you decided that you didn't want a story in a dystopian future, and that you decided for to have a comedic tone. So what was behind all that?
Of course, it is very tempting to also invent a future world. Obviously, I mean, it's better if you have a lot of $100 million to do that. But it doesn't mean that you cannot do it with a small budget. But we thought it might be, in our case, more interesting to put this in our world and to have Alma, a woman like us, you know, who has no more knowledge about the future than we do. And maybe it's easier to identify with her and meeting this future element, this incredible developed robot, is so foreign to her like it would be for us. And also it allows a concentration on, you know, the initial thought of it, you know, having a robot in front of you so developed that he might be your life partner or love partner, right? If you would also invent a future world, then you would have to decide for a future of society, a political future, and we like the idea to set it in a fairy tale atmosphere. And that would also, you know, allow a very humorous, at least, beginning of it. And it was, yeah, I mean, there is something, if you talk about love, I mean, it has to have some humor, right? I mean, it's...
If you talk about loneliness, it has to have some humor.
If you talk about loneliness, it has to be really funny.
What can you say about what the film says about the relationship with technology? Do you think it is possible to fall in love with a robot?
Well, do you think it's possible to fall in love with a human being? I think if love in general is possible, it's pretty much possible to fall in love with anything. I mean, if you look at fetishes, you can also fall in love with a shoe. So I think it's absolutely possible to fall in love with an artificial intelligence. The question is, and that's what we were interested in, is it something you would want to do? Especially because if this artificial intelligence is just made to fulfill your needs. And that's, I think, the question I'm interested in.
Probably it's a question of what is happiness and how do we think about love and happiness. And so far, I mean, at least until today, we look at it as a gift from something happening to us, given from the gods or fate or a happy moment or a coincidence. And I think this makes us all equal, because it's something money can't buy. And it's not a question if you're rich and famous or successful, or if you have only one leg. You know, actually, it's open to, we all have the same concept of that happiness is something which you encounter. It's nothing you can buy so far. You can't buy tools to comfort yourself a bit. But and probably Tom is a very, very well-developed tool. And his only existence, the only reason for his existence is named Alma, to make her happy and to guess, to sense her needs and to adapt to her. So if a kiss is available whenever you want it, if there is not a possibility of failure, if there is not a possibility of misunderstanding, conflict, various interests or colliding interests, then what's it worth? That is probably one of the questions we are not really prepared to answer, because no one of us hasn't experienced someone like Tom yet.
To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK. That's fred.fm/UK.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, it's almost time to say goodbye, but before we do, it's time for this week's Popcorn Classics, the weekly segment where I highlight an alternative cinema title for you to sink your eyes and ears and mind into, and for you to discover some of these films you may have seen, but some you may have not seen. You may not even have heard about them. In any case, these are films that I would recommend and I believe may help you in furthering your exploration in the cinematic art form and help you earn that coveted black belt in cinephilia. This week's film is quite a recent one, from 2019 in fact, but I also feel that it is a film that may have slipped under your radar. It's called The Assistant, and it's a very focused, somber yet intense drama about a young woman named Julia who works as an assistant to a powerful film executive. It follows a day in her life and her daily routine as she grows increasingly aware of the insidious abuse that threatens every aspect of her position. For sure, it's quite evident that this film was inspired by and reflects the sentiments of the outrage of the Me Too movement, and Julia represents a possible hope for the future. The style reminded me a lot of Jean Dielman by Chantal Ackerman, one of the feminist classics in alternative cinema history par excellence. And I should mention that its director, Kitty Green, is also the editor of the movie, and this may be the reason for the confident control of pacing that one may notice and admire of this film. As well as that, the stylistic approach may owe something to the documentary background of the filmmaker herself. This, in fact, is her fiction directorial debut, and a great one at that. This is the type of film that sucks you into its world and has been rightly defined as subtly, quietly devastating. It is my pick for this week's Popcorn Classics, and I leave you with it. Again, a powerful film titled The Assistant from 2019 and directed by Kitty Green for your alternative cinema viewing. And don't worry about its relatively low rating on IMDb. Those are rarely to be trusted. Take it from me, you have to get on this film's case and watch it as soon as you can. And I leave you with that recommendation, cinephile. It has been great. It has been fun. Don't forget to tune in next week for more Big Fred Tuesday goodness. And don't forget also that there is plenty more content for you to listen to absolutely free of charge in multiple languages across all our various channels. So, till the next time, stay healthy, stay safe, stay strong, stay cinephile, and stay tuned to Fred Film Radio, the festival insider.
Fred.
Benvenuti su Fred Film Radio, the festival insider.
This is Fred Film Radio, I'm Eddie Bertotti.
Clémence Ferry-Latour for Fred Film Radio, en direct du Festival de Cannes.
Antani, sono senza un soccino, hanno scioccato.
Alan Beconfi, Fred Film Radio, Marco Mamoragon.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Fred Film Radio.
24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.